This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, fallout from the failed coup in Turkey. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It's been about 1 month since Turkey's elected government withstood a dramatic, bloody coup attempt by a mutinous faction in the military. More than 250 people were killed and over 1,000 were injured. In the weeks since, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has presided over an unprecedented purge of state institutions and civil society, arresting and detaining thousands while suspending or firing tens of thousands from their jobs. Ankara says the coup was instigated and orchestrated by Fethullah Gülen, a Turkish imam based in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania, who at one time was a close ally of President Erdogan. They had a falling out about 2013 when Erdogan accused followers of Gülen, who held positions in the judiciary, of orchestrating a corruption inquiry that implicated Mr. Erdogan's inner circle. An arrest warrant was issued to Mr. Gülen in 2014, accusing him of directing a, quote, armed terrorist organization. Currently, Turkey has requested his extradition from the United States. The coup attempt united Turks across the political spectrum, from conservative Islamists to secularists, in defense of Turkey's democratic institutions and elected government. However, strains between NATO member Turkey and the United States have grown over the extradition request for Mr. Gülen, which Washington is studying, and over what Ankara perceives was a less than robust show of support for Turkey as the coup unfolded. Well, with us to discuss the internal and external fallout from the failed coup are two distinguished regional analysts. Amrin Zaman is a public policy fellow in the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's also a columnist for the independent Turkish online news portal Diken, as well as for AlMonitor.com. And many years ago, she was correspondent for The Voice of America. And Nick Danforth, he's senior policy analyst in the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a Washington-based think tank. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both. Well, Amrin Zaman, it's a delight to have you here back at the Voice of America. Welcome back. First, I want to ask you about the coup attempt. Were you taken by surprise by this July 15th attempt, and how different, in your view, was this coup attempt from previous ones that have afflicted the country?
I was totally taken by surprise, knocked off my chair. In fact, when word came of unusual activity on the Bosphorus Bridge, I was in Istanbul at the time, and I just crossed that bridge like half an hour prior to these reports. I thought that there must be a sort of high ISIS threat alert going on, something along those lines. And that's why these extraordinary measures were being taken, you know, to defend the bridge, Atatürk's mausoleum, etc. So, yes, highly unexpected. And how is it different from previous coup attempts? Well, the last hard coup attempt, or rather successful coup, was in 1980, when the military directly intervened and seized power. But since then, military intervention has taken the form of sort of strong admonitions to the governments that they didn't like, as in 1997, when they basically forced Turkey's first Islamist government out of power. The difference this time also is that this coup was prevented, and prevented by the people. The people took to the streets, and this is the first time in the history of modern Turkey that that's happened.
Turning to you, Nick Danforth, for your reaction to the coup. I know I myself watched it unfold on television through Twitter, and by the end of the evening, you know, it had ended. What are your takeaways from this and how it differs from previous attempts?
I think before this, a number of analysts, both in Turkey and abroad, had concluded quite confidently that there was no possibility of there being a coup in Turkey. And in a way, they were proven right to the extent there was not a successful coup in Turkey. I guess what people had implicitly assumed is that the people in the military who might stage a coup would have been wise enough to realize that absent popular support, absent, it appears, even enough support within the military hierarchy, it would be foolhardy to stage a coup. And through some combination of foolhardiness and perhaps desperation, they went ahead with it anyways. The nation, Turkish democracy, paid the price. But as Amrin pointed out, it could have been far worse had people not come out on the street and actually, in many cases, quite courageously stood up to soldiers' tanks firing on them and, you know, prevented a takeover.
Indeed, an attack on the parliament as well. So back to you, Ambrin Zaman, to get to the factors that may have led to this and who may be behind it. Now, we're hearing a lot about this imam who was here in the United States in Pennsylvania, Fethullah Gulen. It appears that not just the government, but many Turks seem to implicate him. What are your thoughts with respect to who and what may be behind this coup and the timing of it?
Well, the who part is, again, something that sets this coup apart from the others, because for the first time we have a religiously inspired group, movement, whatever you want to call it, the government calls it a terrorist organization, implicated. And would I be surprised if they were involved? Not at all, because we have to look at the backstory here. There's been a steady sort of escalation in the Gulen movement's attempts to undermine the government ever since they sort of fell out. And we can trace that back to around 2011, when they called in Turkey's spy chief, Hakan Fidan. When I say they, prosecutors who were thought to be linked to the Gulen movement and were looking to lock him up over his alleged collusion with the PKK, the Kurdish group that's been fighting for self-rule in Turkey since 1984. So there's been this steady escalation taking aim at the government. You mentioned the corruption probe. And I'd also heard for some time that there were indeed officers, mid-level and even some generals inside the army who were closely affiliated to Fethullah Gulen. And we also know that the president, Erdogan, had been putting enormous pressure on the army chief, the previous army chief, Necdet Özel, and laterally on the current army chief, Hulusi Akar, to weed them out. But for some reason, they'd been resisting. And that's an interesting question. Why? Because you'd think that an organization that, you know, says there to defend secularism would surely want to get rid of, as it has in the past, anyone who holds faith or an Islamic leader, shall we say, above their loyalty to the state. So, yes, they seem to be involved, but what we need is solid evidence, obviously. And you mentioned the fact that the Turkish public seems to believe this. Well, they're being blasted with propaganda almost every day, telling them that this is what happened. And it's very hard to separate the facts from conjecture at this point. And this, of course, makes the relationship with the United States that much more difficult, but I'll leave it there.
Indeed, a very interesting response. Well, back to you, Nick Danforth, for your take on to what extent we know if Fethullah Gulen and his followers have anything to do with the coup. Again, you may want to add to who he is. He's an imam. I mean, he was close with Erdogan just up until 2011, 2013, when things, you know, started to fall apart. Is this a power struggle at root? I mean, how do you see this?
Part of what's made this such an issue in U.S.-Turkish relations, and, you know, it does seem like we're moving towards a slow-motion train wreck over this issue, is that Turkey has been very insistent that the United States extradite Fethullah Gulen. Obviously, if it turns out he was implicated in leading this coup, that would be a very reasonable request. The problem is everyone in Turkey is completely convinced, not just members of his movement that were involved, but that he personally ordered and orchestrated it. No one in the United States is necessarily denying that. There's, I think, people, you know, everyone that I've talked to in D.C. seems entirely open to this possibility. But people, A, they want convincing evidence, and more particularly, if there's going to be an extradition, the United States legal system requires that there be enough evidence for a judge in Pennsylvania to decide that there's probable cause to let the extradition go forward. And what's been creating so much frustration is that the Turkish government seems to view this desire for evidence as an affront, basically suggesting that if the United States fails to extradite Gulen for any reason, that shows that the United States in some sinister way is harboring him. And so whereas I think there might be some hope of resolving this successfully, were the Turkish government to simply come out with American assistance, America's offered to assist the Turkish government, present the best case they have, marshal all the evidence they've undoubtedly been collecting, and try to get the extradition to go through, Instead, there's been a slew of kind of outrageous conspiratorial accusations against the United States, which undermines the government's credibility. There have been examples of what clearly seem to be confessions given under duress. Even the newspaper articles printing many of these confessions appear next to a picture of the military officer involved in the coup with blood streaming down his face. And it's unfortunate for those of us who do want to see both countries get to the bottom of this, do want to see, you know, justice be served and the truth come out, that in some ways Turkey seems to be sabotaging what's potentially the best evidence that it has, linking Fethullah Gülen to the coup.
Back to you, Amrin Zaman. Why do you think President Erdogan is not exhibiting more patience with respect to this extradition request of the United States?
Well, we have to remember his roots. He sprang from Turkey's Islamist movement, and they inhabit a world, very often, shall we say, inhabit a world where everything is a conspiracy, you know, and where the United States, the West, is assigned sort of enormous influence and the ability to sort of determine the future of X or Y country. And to me, that exhibits an incredible insecurity, really. And it's a pity because Turkey has such enormous potential, we keep saying, and it's a very important country. And I think part of it stems, and I think Nick can talk much more authoritatively about this being a historian, it speaks to this sort of hangover from the loss of an empire. But to be more specific, why is he pointing fingers at the United States? It is partly probably because he believes they were involved. And also it's a useful way of diverting attention away from the very massive intelligence failure that occurred. But also, to be fair, the United States response I found was pretty pathetic, really, because early on, rather than expressing immediate support for democracy in Turkey and for its democratically elected government, you know, regardless of whether they were in command of the facts or not, but just as a statement of principle, in my view, was a huge mistake and has allowed the government to build up these conspiracy theories. Second, of course, the fact that some Turkish commanders in Incirlik were involved in this, and the fact that these planes that were refueling the F-16s that were, you know, bombing the parliament, etc., were taking off from Incirlik, of course, immediately led people to think that the Americans must be involved because there's a big American presence at the Incirlik airbase.
That's a very interesting response. Before we go to a break, let me get back to you, Nick Danforth. No question, anti-Americanism sort of runs deep in Turkey, way precedes this current failed coup, conspiracy theories. But what about Amrin Zaman's point that many Turks across the political spectrum were furious that the United States and others did not show the degree of empathy or outrage initially at this attempt on Turkish democracy, that they took a little too long? Is there something to that?
Definitely. And there's still been a frustrating, I think, hesitance on the part of the United States to really come to terms with how brutal this was, how traumatic it was. And, you know, even on the issue of the extradition, I mean, of course, the United States is bound by its laws. But nonetheless, to the extent that we can convey to Turkey how seriously we take this, convey that we're eager to get to the bottom of this, too, that seems very important.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Amrin Zaman. She's Public Policy Fellow in the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Nick Danforth, he's Senior Policy Analyst in the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We're talking about the fallout from the foiled Turkish coup attempt on July 15th and its effect on Turkish relations with the United States. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a new listener, Nima Batali from Jigawa State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Amrin Zaman, because, you know, even prior to this failed coup attempt, President Erdogan was cracking down on civil society, on critics in the media and elsewhere. And some say that he's now using this failed coup attempt, a very traumatic event in Turkish history, perhaps as a pretext to crack down even further, that some of the people he's arrested and detained and so forth perhaps don't agree with him, but they're not necessarily implicated in any way or suspects. What is your view?
Well, Turkey's back to being the number one jailer of journalists in the world. 76,000 people have been dismissed from their jobs. Where does one start? What's happening in Turkey as we speak is terribly alarming, of course. But sadly, very few people can speak up, because the minute one does, one is labelled a putschist, a supporter of the Gulen terror network, etc. So any sort of sensible debate of what's happening has been stifled. And of course, the fact that on the one hand, the president talks about national unity, and when he held this rally last Sunday in Istanbul, massive rally, he decided to exclude the Kurds from that, of course, it sort of belies his claim that he's seeking national unity, when a very important segment of the population, or at least a party that was elected to parliament by many, many Kurds, is excluded.
Why were they excluded? Because I thought the Kurdish party was very supportive of the solidarity after this failed coup attempt.
Well, it's a very good question. You would think that the government would have seized this opportunity sort of to put past rancor behind them and move on and resume some kind of dialogue with the Kurdish party. But it would seem that perhaps the government or Mr. Erdogan is looking ahead to a referendum or elections and wants to keep his nationalist base.
Well, turning to you, Nick Danforth, about the question of whether Erdogan is using the coup as a pretext or excuse to further crack down on simply dissent or differing views. I mean, can we distinguish between sort of valid punishment for those who are suspected or implicated in the coup and an unjustified crackdown on those who simply disagree with Erdogan?
What's striking to me is that before the coup even, the Turkish government used the threat of this Fethullah Gulen terrorist organization as an excuse to crack down on media organizations, journalists, some of whom were quite clearly affiliated with the organization, some of whom weren't. And many of us, myself included, were dismissive of this and thought it reflected a degree of paranoia. Clearly, to some extent, the paranoia was much more justified than we thought. At the same time, what's striking is that when the coup occurred, unlike what the government seemed to be suggesting, you know, no one outside the military was involved in it. The military plotters, unlike previous Turkish coups, actually seem to have made very little effort to bring in the media organizations, to bring in the other aspects of civil society, which the government had repeatedly said were involved in plotting against Erdogan. And so that does seem to be the question. You know, I think everyone agrees, I mean, yes, purging the military is a perfectly reasonable response if there are other individuals that are, you know, implicated, had contacts with the coup plotters. But, you know, what stands out is that largely outside of the individuals who led the coup, there was very little support. And that ideally should be a sign of confidence for the government.
And what's going to happen to all of these people who are being held and detained? Will they be replaced and by whom?
That'll be a big indicator of how, you know, stable and potentially democratic things might be eventually going forward. You know, it's possible that they really will make a sincere effort to look at who was potentially involved and release the people who weren't. But unfortunately, that seems unlikely. And unfortunately, what seems more likely is that the number of people will expand. And instead of simply going after people who might potentially have had some relation to the Gulen movement, it really will turn into an even more sweeping crackdown against opposition.
To get back to the Kurds also, you know that there was a raid that was staged on the headquarters of the HDP in Istanbul, and we've had further violence in the southeast with policemen being killed and the PKK threatening to reignite the war in the cities. So, of course, that also will give the government further ammunition, perhaps to extend emergency rule beyond the 3 months. So the idea, or the hope rather, that things will turn more democratic and Turkey will become a more sort of happy, stable place seems sort of fanciful at this point.
Indeed. Well, before we close, we need to talk about President Erdogan's recent meeting with
Vladimir Putin in Russia. It was the first meeting since Ankara shot down a Russian plane last November. And it was leading to speculation that Erdogan may be pivoting so-called toward the east, you know, away from the traditional NATO orientation. I don't think anybody's disputing that Turkey is still an important and integral part of NATO. But is it mostly about trade and economic ties, or do you see more strategic implications, Ambrin?
Well, I think the cost of this row has been huge for Turkey. And I think that President Erdogan recognized this very quickly because very soon after the plane was downed, he changed his tune and he was lobbying really hard to fix relations with Putin and was repeatedly snubbed. He even sent his spy chief, Hakan Fidan, to Moscow. But what Putin was demanding was an apology, and nothing short of an apology and compensation would do. And so finally in June, it was disclosed that Erdogan had sent a letter in which he sort of did apologize, but I think both sides recognize that this sort of estrangement was not serving either of their interests, and particularly, as you said, on the economic front. For Turkey, the Russian tourists are terribly important, the income that they generate, the fact that, you know, Turkey is able to export its agricultural produce to Russia, and Turkish contractors do lots of business there. But, of course, the elephant in the room remains Syria, and while Turkey and Russia say they've established this sort of committee to discuss Syria and to find common ground there, you know, what Russia essentially would like from Turkey is for it to pull the plug on the Syrian opposition. And in exchange, Turkey would probably want them to stop supporting the Syrian Kurdish militia there, the YPG. But that doesn't seem like that they can actually agree on all of those things. First of all, Turkey can't act independently of Qatar and Saudi Arabia in Syria. It's very sort of deeply now entrenched there with them in supporting the opposition. And clearly, Turkey would like to wait and see what happens if and when Hillary Clinton comes to power and see whether she'll shift policy closer to their way of seeing things, meaning much more engagement, maybe no-fly zones, that sort of thing. So to me, it seems unlikely that Turkey will change its position on Syria in any sort of dramatic way anytime soon. And not only that, of course, for Turkey, these rebels are a useful sort of proxy against the Syrian Kurds. So would they want to dispense with that without getting something much firmer in exchange, either from Russia or, ideally, the United States?
Nick Danforth, the last word to you with respect to where do things go from here in terms of Turkey's relationship with the United States, with NATO, and now given this newfound sort of rapprochement, one could say, between, you know, Erdogan and Putin, what are we to make of this?
Right. I mean, I think you could say that Erdogan's meeting with Putin went about as well as you could hope for two longtime geopolitical rivals that are currently locked in a bloody proxy war. You know, even when you look at the statements they made in the immediate aftermath at the press conference, the focus was clearly on returning to the pre-crisis relationship where they had mutually beneficial economic relationships. But again, we're very much at odds in Syria. And there's no evidence so far that Russia, at least, which I think thinks it's holding a stronger hand, is willing to make Turkey any of the concrete concessions on Syria that might actually create the basis for a more durable relationship. You know, at the same time, there's also, you know, there are tensions over Cyprus, there are tensions in the Caucasus, there are tensions in the Black Sea. None of that means that things are going to continue to go well with NATO. I mean, that relationship's going to remain under an enormous amount of stress. I don't think there's any reason to talk about Turkey leaving NATO. Turkey's territorial integrity is still very important for the United States.
What about the use of Incirlik for sorties to attack ISIS? Will that be okay in terms of Turkey and the United States? Because that was an important base, and it is an important base for the U.S.
And that's been a sensitive issue between the United States and Turkey for so long. And now I think for the first time, you're really seeing people on the U.S. side starting to look for alternatives to Incirlik because they're not sure they're going to have access to it. And they don't want to be dependent on Turkey for access to it.
Let's not forget that ISIS poses a very enormous threat to Turkey, a far greater threat to Turkey probably than to the United States. We have a 90-kilometer-long border with ISIS. They control 90 kilometers of the territory along the Turkish border. And they've organized attacks against Turkey, most recently the Atatürk airport in Istanbul. So you would think that Turkey would be very keen to see ISIS defeated, and obviously very hard to achieve without U.S. help.
And on that cautiously optimistic note, that is all the time we have. On this edition of Encounter, I'd like to thank my guests, Ambrin Zaman, Public Policy Fellow in the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Nick Danforth, he's Senior Policy Analyst in the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.